Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we are going to talk about a new book on the market called The Strategy Strikes Back, and we're very excited to have one of the editors, Major Matt Kavanaugh, on the show, and then Kelsey Atherton, who's been on the show talking about other topics, but we're having him back on the show to talk about this. So first and foremost, thank you both for being on the Loopcast.
Excited to be here.
So for those that might not know, Major Kavanaugh is an active duty Army strategist and a non-resident fellow with the Modern War Institute at West Point. He has many writings that have appeared in numerous publications such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, to list a few. And as I said, he is a co-editor, and he also co-wrote The Strategy Strikes Back. And the full title is How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict. So this is going to be a very fun topic to talk about. And those that might not know Kelsey is a staff writer for C4ISRNet and Fifth Domain, and he's also the co-founder of Grand Blog Tarkin. So thank you for both being on the show. And why don't we start off with just coming up with how did this book come about? Because it's very creative, it's very interesting, and it has some fantastic ways of looking at strategy from a not-so-conventional viewpoint.
This is Matt. I'll probably go run with that one. You know, for me, in a lot of ways, this book, if the first film title was A New Hope, then this book is a new lens. It's a new way, a fresh perspective on modern conflict and military strategy. So I taught for a few years at West Point, and obviously when I did, I was older than the cadets that were in my classroom. And there's a generational gap there. There are things that I know about modern conflict that they don't, and vice versa. So when you're trying to bridge those generational gaps, it really matters to have some sort of common terrain, some place that you can all come together, some place that you all know. And I felt like I didn't have that. And I left that assignment, and I actually went to an assignment in Korea where I served in an infantry division forward stationed. And the staff that I was on was half Korean Army officers. And those Korean officers know a heck of a lot about the Korean War, but almost nothing about the American Civil War or the Second World War or other conflicts that I'm more familiar with. So there was a cultural gap there as well. And while I was in Korea, you know, there was this sort of moment, an epiphany almost, and I talk about it in the prologue, or I think it's the introduction to the book, where I sort of had this realization that Star Wars is a war. It's the one war we all know something about. You know, whether you're a cadet, a colonel, or a Korean, it crosses languages, cultures, generations. And it's even bigger than that. Civilians know Star Wars. And I know that there was a lot of talk about how the most recent, the Han Solo film, didn't hit its box office expectations. But a lot of people still went to see that movie. And so in a lot of ways, Star Wars is a common piece of terrain. It's a place where pretty much anybody that knows anything about Star Wars can come together and use it as a jumping off point to learn some bigger lessons about war in our modern world.
Kelsey, do you have any thoughts on that as well?
Sure. So I was happy to be invited onto the Strategy Strikes Back project back before it was settled on a name or anything, but it reminded me a lot of the same or a similar impulse that went into creating Grand Blog Tarkin, which was there were a lot of people that I knew and were just talking in the national security space who had ideas they wanted to explore about wars that didn't fit really in any, there was no place to publish thoughts on them that was like specifically science fiction focused that would get at how conflict works or how we see conflict working outside of like the real wars. There's a lot of like commentary on like wars as they've happened, or a lot of commentary on the wars that are popular in the American imagination, right? Like, there's a lot of thought about, like, we have the Revolution, we have the Civil War, we have World War II, and then, like, Korea and Vietnam, and those anchor sort of our understanding and our metaphors for war. But Star Wars is a pretty common text. That's why I went with Grand Blog Tarkin for that project. And I think just having a way to delve into that space, to look at the strategic complexities where no one is, like, super ideologically aligned personally with, like, the Empire or the Rebellion. Those are fictional entities, and it's fun to see how they play out. And I think it's a lot of freedom to work about that. And I like to, I personally like to think of Strategy Strikes Back as almost a spiritual successor to the work of Grand Blog Tarkin.
And that's a great point, that the universe of Star Wars and the different sides that are battling against each other really do provide a neutral ground to discuss strategies that are pertinent to today's time. I mean, of course, there are going to be some diehard Star Wars fans that do associate with one side or another, but why don't we discuss this idea of this neutrality and using art, especially science fiction art, as a way to explain strategy?
Yeah, well, this is Matt again. Fiction is fun, you know. When Tim O'Brien, the author, the writer of The Things They Carried, when he was asked why he used fiction to help people understand the Vietnam War, he said essentially because fiction can make you feel. In a way that raw data just can't make you feel war. You know, too often when we crack open a newspaper, war is broken down into numbers, places, and dates. 12 soldiers were killed at location X on date Y, and it's just devoid of all sentiment and feeling. But you know, if I can tell you a story, if I can get you to kind of embody what it might have felt like to exist in that conflict just for a fraction or a sliver of a moment, then in a lot of ways that's much more powerful than any raw recitation of a historical fact or a contemporary news report ever could. And, you know, to some extent, those of us in the uniform military, so I'm like, was previously mentioned, I'm an active duty Army major, so anything I say reflects my own opinions and certainly not the rest of the organization, the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense. But I think one thing that when we're looking for lessons about modern war, we've often looked to two places, and we've mined those two places to the greatest depths that can be imagined. So we look to history. The American Civil War, for example, there have been over 70,000 books written about that conflict, more than one per day since the end of the war. We've mined history for ideas. If you look at theory, Sun Tzu's Art of War, during the Song Dynasty alone in China, there were 43 separate 1,000-page commentaries written on that tiny little book. We've mined the theory for ideas as well. And so to me, fiction, just like Grand Blog Tarkin and other venues like this, I mean, this is what I meant when I said a new lens. This is a new way of finding lessons to put to use in modern war and even beyond.
So what makes the Star Wars universe particularly suited to discuss strategy?
I'll take this one. I think what's so good about Star Wars for discussing strategy is that there are a lot of individual, like, set piece battles, and then the arc of the conflict is pretty clear. And you have your asymmetric fights, you have your squads and your boarding actions, you have honestly, like, surprise insurgency in Return of the Jedi, right, where suddenly the occupiers have to deal with a population they didn't realize was hostile and armed enough to matter. And you also get, some just iconic moments, like the Battle of Hoth and both battles around the Death Stars, where you have, crucial technologies and then crucial technologies that fail or are inadequate to the task to which they've been designed. And so it's a lot of room with a pretty familiar language and pretty accessible. No one, I think, is going to be particularly upset if you misclassify a walker as an infantry fighting vehicle instead of an armored support or something. But you can still get the sense of this is big and carrying people and shooty, and that means something different. And what is the ways to stop that?
And Major,
I would amplify that. Oh yeah, I would just amplify that and say that it's the length in a lot of ways to me. So I've taken a little bit of flack, and I'm fine with it. I think it's appropriate, but I think it's defensible to say that Star Wars is the Peloponnesian War for the modern world. Maybe not in every respect, but certainly in terms of its reach and its length and width of such an epic and long conflict spanning generations. Depending on how you count, we're at 6 decades plus in the saga films. And, wars are like that. They grind on for an awful long time, and they go through ebbs and flows, and they go through different iterations and stages. And what happened before influences what's to come. The rock in the river of war alters the course of the current, but it never stops the current. And so I think it's the length. And then the other reason is that I think that it's the aspects of the conflict, not the specifics. So Kelsey wrote one of my favorite essays in the book. And whereas it's not a specific, you can't find specifics in Grand Moff Tarkin's strategy in the real world. I mean, there's nobody walking around with a planet-killing weapon, right? But the idea that you would seek to instill fear in your opponent with your overwhelming superiority and strength is something that is widely applicable in most, if not many, conflicts. So I think it's those two things, the length, and then it's aspects or themes from the Star Wars films as opposed to the specifics.
On the flip side, what might be the limits of using Star Wars or any piece of science fiction to describe and analyze strategy?
And I think one of the fundamental limits of the structure and the narrative arc of the trilogy is it's hard to see what the Emperor's personal political play is, because the Sith have a really weird and narrow ideology that requires super powerful beings to constantly be scheming against each other and exterminating all others. It's narrow. It doesn't quite match up. It's why when I look at Star Wars, I really am most fascinated by Mon Mothma or General Organa or Moff Tarkin, who are the people actually implementing the moving parts of it. But there's obviously limits to how far you can go. I think it's an incredible resource for 101 for getting familiar metaphors out there. It's sort of a Darmok at Tanagra for strategy language. It's metaphors that can be expanded and applied, but no one is going to, we don't have a real world scenario of you have to plan a ground assault while spaceships escape, and there's a generator, and also there's a powerful cannon that disables your fleet in orbit. There's just the nature of the universe itself hits hard walls pretty fast.
I'd actually just continue to amplify what I was just saying, that you're not going to get a lot out of the Jawas. You know, you're not going to get a lot out of the specific peculiarities that pop up in the films. You know, it's sort of clear and obvious to anyone that magic such as the Jedi possessed is not on offer for us as something that we can use and wield and learn in our own world. But strategy sure is. I mean, just the thought that you have this powerful mechanism between your ears that you can reason and you can see forward through time and see the consequences of potential actions and avoid the ones with the most downside and lean towards the ones with the greatest upside. I think that if you set yourself on the right, you've got a fine-tuned sense of your ability to separate the fantastical from the real, the aspects of the story that can be applied to the real world, then I think that's where the right barometer is.
I also want to take a second to build on that, where we talk about, like, there's some obvious limitations to how we talk about Star Wars and apply those lessons to other strategy. But we also, like, the other dominant narratives, especially in, like, American political culture, of talking about wars are, like, parables or examples drawn from Vietnam and from World War II. And the technology there does not match the tactics, only superficially resemble in a lot of ways what we're doing now. There are other big set of useful metaphors is, I think, similarly limited, but not treated as such because it's historic.
What would you say is the portrayal of strategy in society in Star Wars, in the sense of we tend to have this idea that the good guys tend to ultimately win in these movies? How does that apply to strategy in real life, or when you're trying to use something like Star Wars to discuss strategy where the good guys don't always win?
So the first part of the question, how is strategy portrayed popularly? Sometimes it comes off as sort of scheming and evil. You know, my own essay in the book was evaluating Yoda's performance as a strategist. And our minds have been sort of hijacked by Jar Jar Binks in those first three films, when George Lucas went back and did episode 1, 2, and 3. But if you watch those films again, there's actually a lot of nuance in those films, and I actually think that there's almost more lessons in those first three films than in all the rest of them. And you know, in going back and looking at Yoda's performance across those episodes 1, 2, and 3, you see pretty clearly that he performed pretty poorly. You know, there's this popular myth that Yoda's just amazing because he's so gymnastic and he's flipping and flying and, you know, he's so short and he's so deadly with a lightsaber. And I'll grant that. I love that part of Yoda. But his performance in those first three films is very poor, and conversely, his opponents do very, very well. And I think earlier we've already been talking about sort of that good evil dichotomy, that split. And I think sometimes effective strategy gets kind of lumped with the bad guys as schemers and plotters and that sort of thing. And the good guys kind of just think in the moment. And I'm worried about that a little bit, you know, because because I want, you know, I want the good guys to be skilled with strategy. And so, you know, that's one of the themes or the narratives that I think gets covered in the films, but also that we pick up on in the book.
What are your thoughts, Kelsey?
Yeah, so I think one of the things, and this is actually probably the greatest strength of the prequels, is showing a existing governing order and like security establishment completely unprepared for war. And it's not like there's obviously arms and armies and forces in the universe prior to when everything opens up with the blockade of Naboo. But what we really see is that the Jedi Order had built themselves into a position of being able to negotiate with magic, because the Force, but basically negotiate and establish peace. And they hadn't really thought about what happens if there's a concerted multi-planetary effort against it. And so that's really, I mean, it's explored okay in the prequels, and I think explored really, really well in the Clone Wars show. Of what happens when they have to adapt to fighting a real war, and what happens when you build the institutions of war. The whole Imperial military establishment that goes out of the Old Republic military establishment, that's where you're building and cultivating strategists and officers and the whole logistics and every apparatus you need to win a war, because the Jedi... that's not their skill set. They're very good in individual combat or small combat, and they're good at the negotiations they don't have that strategic vision. They don't understand what it means to take over and control other planets and hold them. And it's something that they learn somewhat through the Clone Wars show, and we see it somewhat happen in the prequels, and they've gotten sort of good at it by the end, but the one tactical or even strategic genius that the Jedi produce is Anakin, who sees the path to power differently, and that's his deep personal conflict and leads him to the Empire. But you have a world that lends itself towards the strategy is only in the side of those consolidating power against those already holding it. And when we move to the newer movies, the original trilogy and then the newer movies, we see strategic thought in development somewhat, right? I think I would put Organa, General Organa, and Mon Mothma up there as the only other really like relevant strategists in there. And it's, I mean, Akbar probably too, but they're late to the game. The rebellion is late to learning how to counter this thing. But it's all, the whole thing happens within really two or three generations of the strategic context changing and building. And so it's neat to see everyone learning on the fly. And I think the films focus obviously on the rebellion and the triumphs of good over evil. I mean, that's cinematic convention as much as anything else, but it's interesting to see what happens when a strategic culture is built and then has blind spots in it. Tarkin never foresaw the Death Star failing. But we see very clearly in Rogue One that it was built to fail because the engineers never really had the full interest of the Empire at heart in building it. I think there's a lot more depth in who thinks strategically and who is learning than just the play-by-play good versus evil that we get.
And considering all of that... go ahead.
Yeah, it's Matt. I'm going to... one last thought, you know. Because you asked specifically about how strategy is portrayed in the films, and one of the key elements is that one of the characteristics of a strategist must always be some anticipation or foresight of what's to come. And you get Yoda in particular pushing back against that. In the way that he teaches and coaches and mentors, and they pay the price for that, for such a small fighting force determined by your blood. And I understand that may have been the Jedi teachings, but at the very least, if not allowing marriage, then a second tier of maybe less genetically rare individuals, but still defenders of the Republic. And you know, out of that, I really take that a strategist is meant to look to the future, to see over the horizon, recognize the requirements to come, and build resources so that surprise does not turn into regret. So I, you know, that's really what jumps out at me about how they portray strategy over the course of the films. Sorry.
How would you say that we can incorporate the idea of a dystopia or a dystopian view into analyzing strategy, considering Star Wars, but considering strategy in real life?
And I think one thing, because we have, it's hard to look at Star Wars as like a society that fell and descended into dystopia. It's had dystopic elements from the start. That's how we meet Anakin, right, is when he is enslaved. And then that's to say nothing of how they deal with droids. But I think what's interesting to look at is a societal, like, is the societal collapse from a rough democratic confederation in the old republic to the totalitarian fascistic empire, the very tightly controlled state. And that can happen within duration, but it doesn't happen uniformly. And the empire's entire strategic model after it wins the Clone Wars, after it's established a rough monopoly on force, is trying to figure out how to quash rebellion, and it has no good answers. It knows that its policies are repressive. There's nowhere in there where they think, should we give them token democracy and lessen that? Should we get buy-in from the populace? It's how do we crush the people who are fighting against us? And that's where the Tarkin Doctrine comes from. That's where the other later strategies, the whole... the First Order seems to operate entirely on a just roaming, crush everything in its way strategy. And it misses what states are built on, and what makes states durable, which is at least some buy-in from the public. And I think one lesson from Star Wars, right, is you cannot do it all from force alone. And we don't really see any attempts by anyone to do it. The rebellion is assumed to have some consent of the governed in the sense that they are a freer people and trying to establish a totalitarian thing, but it all falls apart by Force Awakens. So it's not clear that anyone in the Star Wars universe has any firm grasp on the governance side of things other than the fighting side of things.
Yeah, and this is Matt again. You know, at the very beginning of Episode 1, the Republic rules the galaxy and the Jedi are policing that rule. By the end of the Episode 3, the Republic has fallen, essentially, and the Jedi are two heartbeats away from extinction. There are lessons that we can observe that trajectory and extract lessons. And fiction does that very well. It can show you the road you don't want to travel. Because when we're talking about the future, we're actually talking about many futures, many roads that we could potentially travel on. Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 comes to mind, but even more importantly, our co-editor and co-writer Max Brooks's book, World War Z. My next assignment is actually to U.S. Northern Command, which is, most folks will know it as NORAD, which is responsible for the protection of the American homeland. And inside of that protection includes against threats from fast-moving pandemic disease, the spread of fast-moving pandemic. World War Z is about zombies, but it's not really about zombies. In a lot of ways, you could read it as what governments and individuals and societies and the public would do in response to such a fast-moving pandemic. And so what fiction can do very well, and dystopian fiction especially, is force you into an environment, force you into the unthinkable, really, and get you to confront the consequences of what that might mean. Because the truth is, sometimes the real world is stranger than fiction, and it goes even more sideways than what fiction comes up with. Although I'm still holding out hope that Max's book doesn't come true. But I think that's the value of dystopian fiction in a lot of ways.
Moving on to a more personal level, the two of you had a lot to do with this book, and you've both written sections of it. So what was that experience like, and what were your favorite takeaways from this project? Kelsey, do you want to go first?
Sure, I can go. So my involvement in the production of the book was significantly less. I was no editor here. I think I maybe suggested another writer to include at some point in the process. But for my essay itself, it was really a really neat opportunity to take the thoughts that had been rattling in my head ever since, like, maybe not the first time I watched Star Wars, but maybe like the second or third time, and put them together in a way that was designed to be a gestalt whole. Just get the, what is it about this character that's interesting, and what is it about their strategy that has any relevance to a casual observer? How could I sell Tarkin as a relevant strategist to talk about to someone in like three sentences or in like 30 seconds, and maybe give it, and it's longer than that, obviously, it's a few pages, but being able to go into that space and find that out. And what I think was really neat, and a lot of how Blog Tarkin worked, and we were writing stuff then, was we would write about science fiction, and we would try to draw parallels in there somewhat explicitly sometimes, and sometimes just leave it at science fiction. But I think the tricky parallel for Tarkin is he's a figure entirely built through to deliver peace through order and superior firepower. And so the Death Star, which is like kind of hokey, especially like the second time they tried, like, well, do they have any other ideas? What are the ideas here? You can't just like blow up planets and think that's victory. But what does it take to get you to the point where that's how you see the world, where the way you conceive of counterinsurgency is to simply make the cost of insurgency so high that literal millions die in doing it, right? Like the disturbance in the Force is the death of a planet. And it's a thing that can only really be explored in fiction and only should be explored in fiction, but to have this is the logical end of this long line of thinking of peace through force alone. And maybe after seeing it followed through to that end, it's a really good way to pause and say, maybe this is nothing we should be approaching. Maybe this is the kind of thing where we can leave it safely in the realm of movies about spaceships and lasers and force magic. But it was good. I thoroughly enjoyed writing the piece and working on the book and having it out there, having a different way of thinking about war and a different way of thinking about fiction out there.
Major Kavanaugh?
Yeah, so for me, obviously, I had a different role editing. And one of the things that was just fantastic about doing the book was getting to work with so many people with so many different amazing views. I mean, if you add up the number of years of strategic experience that we have in the writers in the project, we're getting into the many hundreds. Kelsey's essay was highlighted in one of our strongest reviews as the best essay in the book. I had no other cause or call to work with him before this. So that was fantastic. General Stan McChrystal, commander of all forces in Afghanistan, remembers finishing Ranger School as a lieutenant, and then the first movie he went and saw in theaters was A New Hope was episode 4, 1977. You know, that's a piece of common ground that he and I share. That was surprising and really cool, and he wrote about it in the foreword. Colonel Liam Collins, who his PhD dissertation at Princeton is on counterinsurgency theory. No one will ever read that dissertation other than his advisors. But what he did was he took those ideas from his dissertation and planted them into a discussion of several imperial officers at a, you know, what at an imperial staff officer meeting, where they're discussing how to counter the rebel insurgency. You know, so he's able to take what very few people will ever care to read and then inject it into a lot more fun and interesting scenario that a lot more people will benefit from. So the project as a whole, for me, was a lot of fun to get to know more people, read writing that I hadn't even thought about or considered, and learn just how deep and wide the reach of Star Wars is, and how powerful that can be in talking about subjects that most of the time people don't want to talk about. So,
well, we like to give our guests a moment to touch upon something that we might not have discussed in the talk or have a final thought. So I want to hand the floor over to both of you. And why don't we start off with Kelsey?
Sure. My final thought really is something we don't yet, I think, I mean, it might be decades before we do really have the like definitive piece of war on terror fiction or war on terror strategic analysis. The war is long, it's gone through lots of phases, there's a lot going on, and it's an ongoing concern. So we don't really have a way to step back from this thing we are doing and process it. But we do have, a interesting body of work. Obviously, Star Wars has produced, like, the first trilogy is produced post-Vietnam in an era when there wasn't so much of this. But even, like, the second two prequels were produced during this whole thing. And we have a long... The commentary in the work itself isn't intentional, but the way that it's able to be a metaphor that people can look at how we're thinking about war, how we're using even fictional war as entertainment, and then use it to reflect on our present wars. It's neat. I like anything that makes national security and like strategic conversation accessible, because I think it's a pretty ongoing concern, and being able to talk about it in Star Wars metaphor is better than not being able to talk about it at all. And I think it's a common ground. And it's good. I think I'm really happy that the book exists. I was pretty happy to be part of it. And I think the strategic thought is better for leaning into fiction than shunning it.
Yeah, this is Matt. This book in a lot of ways to me is a gateway drug. It's pot. And, you know, we're hoping that people are willing to go off into heroin afterwards. I mean, national security and defense is too often pushed to the side, and these issues are too important to let pass, especially for civilians. So through mid-century, through 2050, we will have spent, according to Brown University, $5.6 trillion on the post 9/11 wars. You know, we're involved in several conflicts worldwide right now. You know, everyone has skin in this game. Armies alone don't fight wars. Societies wage wars. And so that's why this book exists. That's why our next project, and the next book project, is another similar book on Game of Thrones. These conversations matter too much not to use metaphors and pop culture to reach a wider audience, because it's not hyperbole or exaggeration for me to say that my life as a military officer and our wars, the outcome of them, depend on wise civilian choices. So, you know, while this book, you know, it's not, it may not be for everybody, there's something for everybody in this book, and anyone can benefit from some of the chapters in this book.
Well, I want to thank both of you for spending your Monday afternoon with us here at the Loopcast and talking about this really fun and creative way of looking at strategy. And I encourage our listeners to either go to the library and get the book or buy the book, depending on your interest. And hopefully, you know, if you're interested in this topic, you can enjoy it in a new and creative way. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. And like Kelsey, I hope to be a repeat offender someday.
Fantastic. And thank you, Kelsey.
Thank you for having me.